This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just under 3 weeks left to the election on November 5th, and Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, joins us. Ron, things are really kind of unconventional. I don't know how else to put it. It's all over the place. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Happy to be with you.
Are you pulling your hair out of your head yet?
I've been pulling the hair out of my head on elections for many, many years. Fortunately, it keeps growing back, although it's gotten much whiter. But this election here, I'm no longer pulling the hair out of my head here, because I've come to the conclusion that the race is essentially tied. And while things will happen between now and Election Day that could move it a point or two to one side or another, that we're really not going to know until election night, and there's no reason to worry about it. Now, there's reason for the candidates and the campaigns to worry about it, but for those of us who are not part of the campaign, and for average voters who, whether you have a candidate or not, we just have to wait to see what happens. I was looking at, in terms of an update on numbers, poll numbers, at this stage of the game, Harris, her average national lead is about 2%. And my guess is, and this is only a guess, it can change many times, that may be what she ends up with on Election Day in terms of her national popular vote lead. It looks like she has the popular vote advantage at this point, even though it's a small advantage. But, of course, the popular vote plus, as we used to say in Louisiana, that plus a nickel will get you a phone call, and you got to get the electoral votes. And you've got seven states that are sitting on a whole bunch of electoral votes, swing states. And of those seven states, the latest polling shows that Trump has basically a 1 or 2 point lead in three of them, North Carolina, Arizona, and Georgia. And the other four of them, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Nevada, are essentially tied. They're not only within the margin of error, but they're within about a point. So we're at a stage now, and my friends who are pollsters hate when I say this, and they don't like to hear this, but we're at a stage where polls can no longer provide the precision necessary to predict this race. It's just too close, and that's where we are. Now, it's always possible that voters break. There was one poll that came out yesterday, the Harvard Caps poll, that showed about 15 to 18% of the electorate is still capable of moving from where they are now, whether that's going from undecided to one of the candidates or from one candidate to another. And this is something I've been saying for a while, that there's potentially loose votes out there if one candidate picked up most of them, they would win. So the bottom line is that, we just don't know. The polls can't tell us. There's a million moving parts districts in every one of these states. And that's really about where it is now. I think a lot of people felt in the last couple of weeks, not this week, but the prior 2 weeks, that Trump was doing better relative to Harris. But I think this week, I think some of that may have been lost, not real numbers, but in terms of a feeling, the zeitgeist. And I think, you know, people are just, both sides, I think, are very worried, and for good reason.
Do you find that people are getting weary? I mean, I don't know about yes. you, but I November 5th can't come fast enough for me.
I think you're right. I think people are weary, even people who are strong supporters of both sides. And you've got a lot of voters, let's not forget, who don't like either candidate. I mean, they're going to pick one of the two, but they don't like them. So you've got a lot of weariness. People are tired of the campaign. They're tired of all of it, really. And I think as we get closer to the election, I have a column coming out in NOLA.com in the newspaper, probably either tomorrow or Monday, that talks about, you know, what happens after the election if it's close. You know, the court battles, the key moves that the, you know, Electoral College has to be made to determine who wins the electoral vote. And you know, voters right now, only 36% of voters across the country feel like this election is on the level. They feel like it's not honest, and it's not open to all rightful voters. And you also have, when you look at those numbers, you find that only 25% of young voters, many of whom will be voting for the first time, think the election is honest and will be conducted in the right way. So you've got not only a wariness about the campaign, you have fears about the election not coming off well and creating all kinds of bitter disputes and possibly even violent protests. You know, between 40% and 50% of the electorate, depending upon who would win, believe that there will be violent protests as a result of the election. So yes, I mean, there's a lot of reason to be weary, and I think tens of millions of Americans across the country share your feelings on that.
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, in a lot of states, on the eve of the election, we've got this contentiousness about the rules and what we're doing. You know, the DOJ stepping into Virginia, because Virginia has identified non-citizens that are who are on the voters' rolls and they can't vote in the federal election. They typically wait till a period of time before the election to remove them from the voter rolls, and the DOJ says you can't do that. And it's like the last three governors have done it. Going back to Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, when he was governor, he actually signed a bill to go into effect in Virginia, and so people are asking, well, why are you doing that? Why would we want voter rolls that have people that are not citizens that are not allowed to vote? Why would we want to keep them on the voter roll? You know, and it's just these obvious questions that are out there, and you're like, why do we find ourselves in this position?
Well, in the case of Virginia, the reason why the court did what they did, and I'm not defending them because I don't know all the issues, but the stated reason why they did what they did was that there's a state law that prohibits taking voters from off the polls this late in the game. So they are
eligible voters. That's the problem.
Eligible voters.
These folks are not eligible.
And look, if Virginia is close, one of the grounds under the new, you know, Electoral Vote Count Act, to not certify or not to count a state's vote, is if ineligible voters are voting. So, so if Virginia is close, rest assured, we'll go to court.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's amazing how, and let's just flip to issues right now. Do you see any movement where, we've had like these top five issues, the economy, immigration, abortion, crime, and forgot what the fifth one was. But are we seeing any shifting in the sands as to where people place the importance on issues?
There's always a little movement, but basically it's staying the same, that inflation and the economy remains the top issue nationwide and in most swing states. Now, that's among all voters. And then you've got immigration and the border is a big issue nationwide and in most of the swing states. You also have national security. One of the things that the Harvard CAPS poll found was that on specific national security issues, when you talk specifically about the Ukraine war, the war in Gaza with Israel and Hamas, and how Afghanistan was handled, and how the U.S. is dealing with China, when you ask those specific things like that, Trump actually wins those issues by a fairly comfortable margin. So that's something also that is working in his favor. And of course, there's a lot of important news going on about that. So we don't know to what extent that can help him. The other thing, too, is I've done some recent research and found that nationally that crime, that you've got a high percentage of voters and Americans across the country who believe that crime is a very important issue. Now, we're not seeing a lot of national discussion about crime right now as a presidential issue. I suspect you're seeing more of it in the swing states. But that, too, is an important issue for a lot of voters. And so you add up those issues, and outside of abortion, which greatly favors the Democrats, these other issues favor Trump and the Republicans.
There's been a significant fallout, I guess, for lack of a better term, on the Bret Baier interview of the Vice President Kamala Harris. I thought the follow-up questions were appropriate. Typically, candidates, they hate follow-up questions because they tend to put you in a corner and make you answer the question that you didn't answer in the first place. your thoughts about that interview?
Well, first of all, on follow-up questions, I have been shocked in this campaign how the media has let the candidates, both candidates, get away with dodging questions and inadequate answers that didn't directly address the question. And Bret Baier was one of the few interviewers who didn't let that go. He went at the questions, and if the vice president didn't handle the question in a way that answered it, he came back at it. And I think that is appropriate. So I had no problem with what he did there. But in terms of the interview itself, I did not watch that whole interview. And I'm always reluctant to speak with too much surety about something like that when I haven't seen all of it. But what I've seen, I thought the questions were appropriate. And based on what I've seen, it looked to me like she was not answering any of the major questions with a relevant answer. Now, look, Donald Trump does that, too. I have to keep pointing that out. But in the case of the vice president, it didn't look to me like she was answering many of the questions.
Well, the reality is that they want to embrace all of the positives, whatever they may be, from the Biden-Harris administration. But when there's negatives, it's like they want to create the separation by not talking about it at all.
As you well know, in a courtroom, questions are asked to collect the facts, to gather the facts so that you can make a decision. And the American people need answers to questions to gather the facts so they can make a decision. And we've gotten to the point now where so many candidates are dodging every important question, not some of them, but every one of them. In a practice way, that it's very hard to get the facts out about who stands for what to the American people.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, because like on the crime issue, most recently the FBI revised their data, right, where they originally reported that violent crime in 2022 had fallen by 2.1%. They now just recently revised those numbers as they scrubbed the data, and they didn't give it the same hoopla they did when they initially released it. Now we know that in 2022, violent crime increased by 4.5%, which is totally flipped the script on that issue. And it's going to be interesting to see, much like the jobs report, where 800,000 job reduction
was revised.
Right. Was revised, and now you have the same thing with the crime data. And I think this all goes to the folks' speculation about not only the election, but the data, the timing and the release of this, the revision. It was beneficial to one party over the other in the first place, and now the script is completely flipped. And I think that all of that is fueling the skepticism of the voter. And unfortunately, and I think you would agree, the worst possible outcome of all of this is that people just don't go vote.
Well, that's one bad outcome. Another bad outcome is that voters go vote and they cast an uninformed vote, where they're voting for things that may not necessarily relate to these candidates' ability to be a good president. But people are increasingly not believing government statistics on anything. And I've got some recent polling data that shows that. And the other thing is that, the high percentage of people who think that voter disinformation, deliberate falsehoods that are distributed on a mass basis in this presidential campaign are going to affect the outcome. And 68% of the electorate think that's the case. They think that this election will be based on deliberate disinformation. Our democracy is in tatters. And all of this keeps making it worse and worse and worse. And both sides are doing it. They're doing it in different ways. The polls show, frankly, that most voters believe the Republicans are doing it more so than the Democrats. But they believe both parties are doing it. They believe the news media is doing it. They believe other political groups are doing it. And we're getting to a point now where, at what point do voters just don't believe anything anybody produces?
And that is definitely not a good place to be.
Well, how do you have a democracy? A democracy is based on an electorate that has some information. So anyway, I don't want to get into the depths of despair here, and it's very easy. when talking about this election, to end
it's
up.
It's okay, Rod. It's a Friday. You can have a drink after this.
in a cul-de-sac. I'm having a drink every day now. But to get into the cul-de-sac of despair and where we just drive into it and can't get out of it. And I think people on both sides are doing that.
Absolutely.
And if this is a real close election and the final tally's in doubt, we don't know how long this could go on.
It's going to be an interesting night for sure. Ron, as always, totally enjoyed the conversation. Have a great weekend, and I'm sure we'll be talking again before November 5th.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. We will be right back, folks, and we'll visit with Secretary Richard Nelson, the Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Revenue, talking about Governor Jeff Landry's tax reformation plan. So stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Be right back. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by the Secretary to the Louisiana Department of Revenue, Richard Nelson. He has been working on a tax reformation package as proposed by Governor Jeff Landry, and he joins us. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back. I'm glad to be here.
Richard, I wanted to give you a few moments to open up the conversation and explain to the listening audience what the governor's package is attempting to do.
Sure. So I would say it's probably the most comprehensive tax reform package that's ever been proposed in Louisiana. So it's no small thing. It touches pretty much every element of our tax code, the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the sales tax, corporate franchise tax, even severance tax, inventory tax. And it's really trying to look at this picture comprehensively to say how can we build a competitive tax structure so that we can grow the state. I know everybody's probably aware we've been losing population. We lose thousands of people a year, you know, especially our best and brightest kids. They go to places like Texas or Florida, Virginia, somewhere else to find opportunity. And this is trying to reverse that trend and really bring business, jobs, and opportunity here. And then at the same time, give everybody an income tax cut. So every citizen of the state would get an income tax cut. We're looking at dropping the top personal income tax rate from 4.25% down to 3%. And then trying to do something similar with a corporate rate, dropping it from 7.5% down to 3.5%, and getting rid of some of the other taxes that are really uncompetitive, like corporate franchise tax. And we're trying to do this in a way that kind of balances it out. I mean, there's things that are, you know, some people, you know, will, you know, you'll pay a little bit more because maybe an exemption or a sales tax exemption or some kind of credit or incentive program might go away. But on the whole, you know, everybody will be better off in the end. And I think especially in the long-term competitiveness for the state, it'll make the state much more competitive in attracting those new opportunities and new people.
Obviously, most people in the state are not impacted by corporate taxes or, you know, inventory taxes or otherwise. They're going to look solely at the state income tax, right? Is what you guys are proposing, is it a 3% flat tax? So it's a it's an elimination of the graduated tax formula that we have now, and it's 3% from dollar one to the last dollar.
Yeah, so it would be a flat 3% rate, but basically what we do is raise the standard deduction. So that level before you actually start paying tax would go up from $4,500, it would go up to $12,500. And the practical effect is that, you know, the bottom bracket, if you're paying tax in that bottom bracket, you just basically, you wiped out your whole tax liability, so you're not going to owe income tax anymore. And that's about 20% of the state will no longer pay any income tax at all because of that that higher standard deduction. And we also double that standard deduction for seniors. So that means that for, if you're over 65, you're not going to pay tax on your the first $25,000 of your income. And so that's a pretty significant increase on that, or basically a tax decrease for that group. That's about a third of seniors will no longer pay any income tax at all. So it's a pretty significant change, pretty significant income tax cut. And I think it's something that everybody in the state will benefit from.
So the bottom level goes from $4,500 to $12,500. If you're,
that's correct.
If you're married filing jointly, what happens to that 12.5 number, or is it the same?
It's double. It's doubled. So you have, basically, if you're married filing jointly, it'll be the first 25,000 of your income will be tax free, and if you're a senior over 65, then it'll be basically the first 50,000 of your income will be tax free.
So that significantly changes it. I was talking to Jan Moeller, earlier, and we were talking about, you know, the graduated tax plan as it works now, but this really kind of changes it. So the tax savings would even be greater than just the impact of condensing the graduated plan into that one flat rate.
Yes, there's a, basically raising that standard deduction is a significant benefit to the lower income brackets, right? So, you know, a lot of the criticism that sometimes gets, you know, lobbed at income tax cuts is that they benefit, you know, the rich. This is not really, this is a pretty balanced way of doing it, because we're actually giving significant relief at the bottom of that, you know, the bottom of the income bracket too, by raising that standard deduction. So it would wipe, like I said, it would wipe out the liability for 20% of the state that currently pays income tax would no longer have to pay anything.
Yeah, because the average income in Louisiana, what, is about $53,000 or so, somewhere in the 50s? Is
yeah,
that correct?
something like that. That's right. That's the, I think, the median income, family income.
The median family income. So when you look at it in that context, that's a significant amount of money. If you're talking about $12,500 coming off the top of that, right?
Yes, and so you wouldn't have to pay tax until you make, you know, $12,501, and you start paying state sales tax on that, or state income tax on that.
State income tax on that. Now, I'm curious. I know that y'all are proposing expansion of the types of transactions that have not been historically taxed that will be taxed now with sales taxes. Are these going to align from not only state sales tax but local sales taxes as well? And will local government be able to tax those same types of transactions, or are y'all reserving that to the state only?
Yeah, so we're basically going to expand the base of the sales tax to replace some of the revenue that we're losing when we do these income tax cuts, right? So it's really a shift from taxing labor to taxing choices and consumption. And so that base we would expand to all the local government. The local governments will be able to tax that same thing. And part of the idea is, I know you were the sales tax collector for Jefferson Parish. It's a really complicated system, our sales tax system, right? And so we're trying to make more uniformity between what the state taxes and what the locals tax, and make that relatively uniform across the state too, so that, you know, all the parishes tax the same thing. But all these, the additional services and everything that we're trying to allow that we're going to use to increase the state sales tax base would apply to the locals as well. And one of the major things we're trying to do is basically stop the taxation of prescription drugs on the local level, and use this base expansion to basically backfill that revenue for them. So At the end of the day, we're basically going to go from taxing prescription drugs to taxing, you know, car washes and landscaping and dog grooming and those kind of things. So I feel like that's a better way to raise the revenue on those kind of, I would say, more luxury services versus just taxing prescription drugs.
Richard, is there going to be any attempt to look at exemptions that have been on the books for a long time? You know, you probably recognize by now that the state issues these tax exemption certificates, and they're very broad. They're not really regulated very well, in my view. A lot of these exemptions go back to the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, there was a reason that they were given back then. These reasons don't necessarily hold water today because of the change in the economy and the way things work today. I mean, and I know this is a really short period of time before you guys are going to embark upon this endeavor. But is there a desire to look at that at all? I mean, it's about, what, $6 billion in tax exemptions in this state, maybe more. I think it may be more like $7.2 billion now, but depending on inflation. But there's a lot of exemptions out there.
Yeah, so we take a pretty significant look at all of the exemptions across the board, both in the, you know, the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, and in the sales tax. And we honestly get rid of a lot of them and use the income or the additional revenue that we generate from that to lower the income tax rates. So in the sales tax, for example, I think there's 225 sales tax exemptions, and we're looking at getting rid of or consolidating about 100 of them. We use that revenue to reduce the personal income tax rate. On the corporate side, there's a lot of corporate incentive and credit programs that exist in the corporate side that, you know, make it so that we have the highest corporate income tax rate in the South. And we're looking at getting rid of those or sunsetting a lot of those credits and incentives and using that money to reduce the rate for everybody. So typically a lot of those programs and credits, you know, there's maybe 1,000 companies or individuals that use those programs. And then, you know, there's 150,000 corporate income tax filers or 2.5 million personal income tax filers. And so basically, we're going to spread that money out over that whole broad base and lower the rates for everyone. And that's the, you know, the overall goal of this is to have those lower rates for everybody, a simpler, fairer tax.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking more like in the realm of there's certain industry sectors, they used to call them SIC codes. I don't know what they call them now. I forgot. But, you know, that we've given these broad exemptions to on sales taxes. And it was like for cranes and stuff like that. But we find that these companies, I know we did when we began to audit them, were using these tax exemption certificates for everything from toilet paper to the crane. And that wasn't necessarily what it was designed for. It was, you know, the ability for them to buy and replace their machinery. We do a lot of that with being able to advance our accelerated depreciation schedules on equipment and things of that nature in order to make it work for them. But there's really not a lot of limitations on these exemption certificates that have been issued for years. And it just seems to me that we ought to look at that. And I'll move on to something else because we could belabor that point forever. It's amazing. I get in a lot of texts. People had no idea that in some jurisdictions they're actually paying sales taxes on prescriptions, and I'm guilty of the same thing. I never look at my receipt. So
I think it's almost every parish will charge you the local sales tax on prescriptions, and depending on the parish, I mean, the state sales tax rate is 4.45, but the average local rate I think is 5.1%. So you're paying that on your prescription drugs, which is, I think Louisiana is if not the only state that actually charges a tax on prescription drugs.
So that would go away. So no local jurisdiction would be able to tax prescription drugs, correct?
That's correct.
Have y'all, I know that there's, and when I spoke to the governor the other day, I don't mean this in a negative fashion, but there's a scheme relative to the school boards and the shifting of the stipends to try and make them more permanent, pay down the unfunded accrued liability of their pension funds that they're having to pay dollars for. Have we actually figured out that that's going to be revenue neutral for these school boards? I've talked to several school board members of different school boards in the region, and they seem to be very concerned as to whether or not this is going to work out from a financial perspective for them.
Yeah, so I mean, what that element of the plan, that's kind of a kind of kills a couple birds with one stone, right? So we have about an $8 billion unfunded accrued liability, which is the pension debt for the teachers' retirement system, right? All the public school teachers are retired. We promised them these benefits, and we didn't actually put aside the money to pay for it. You know, this is from a long time ago. And so that money actually gets, we accrue interest on that balance of that $8 billion at like 7.25%, so a pretty high interest rate. And so the idea is to take some of this money, there's about $2 billion that are tied up in constitutional funds, and pay off, a quarter of that pension debt. And that payment would save about $300 million a year in annual payments to that debt. And that's the money that we would use to reduce or to provide those long-term teacher raises, because currently the local school systems make the payments on that debt. And so once the state makes that $2 billion payment, it frees up a significant amount of money. And just the way that the constitutional amendment is written, it basically says the money you save, use it to give the teachers a raise. So there's not really a risk that they're going to have to pay out more than they would have done, because the language is that you use the money that you save to give them a raise. It's just the same amount.
Now, I know you guys have been meeting with members of the state legislature, developing the call. This is going to start, November 7th and go to right before Thanksgiving. Is that correct?
Yeah, somewhere around that time, between the election and Thanksgiving.
Is there going to be a package that's going to be put out for the public and the media and others to consume all of the proposed nuances of this program?
Yes. I mean, we have basically we provide a package of bills to the legislature, and they've basically been digesting that. They're currently developing, their set of the fiscal notes that, we gave them our estimates about what we think the different tax changes would cost, and they're developing their own estimates on that. And we're basically fine-tuning the bills based on that initial round of input from the legislature. And I think that package of bills will be released prior to the, relatively soon in front of the session. Plus, we had a pretty thorough vetting of what our initial proposal was a few weeks ago in the Ways and Means Committee. We kind of went through the whole package with them. We've laid these outlines in a couple of legislative committees throughout the summer and into the fall. And I think we have another, the Senate committee that's going to meet next week to kind of discuss, all the different elements of the package as well.
Absolutely. We'd love to get you back on once we are able to have access to some of that information so that we can dig a little deeper on these issues. But we really appreciate you joining us today. We know you're busy, and thank you for the time and the insight.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. It's Secretary Richard Nelson, Secretary of Louisiana Department of Revenue. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. So, folks, as more and more of these details are made known to us about this particular plan, we'll try to do our little back-of-the-envelope calculations and get some experts involved as to what this ultimately means. I do know that there are local sales taxes collected on prescription drugs, and it's a pretty big number for local government that they are going to be looking to have to make up. Where it's taxed, I'm not absolutely certain. I know that we have a lot of folks that are on these prescription drug plans. They have negotiated prices. You're paying a copay. And I'm not exactly sure at what point in the transaction the tax actually applies. I do know that it generates tens of millions of dollars in a lot of different parishes throughout the metro area. So it's a big number. With the information that was provided by Secretary Nelson, with that deduction that you get if you are an individual and you get the first $12,500 that's not taxed, your savings, just my little back of the envelope calculation, is going to be over where the plan is today, is going to be right at about $900 for a married couple filing jointly. That's on $100,000 worth of income. is going to be about $550 in savings, best of my knowledge of my little calculation. And I may be simplifying this too much, but we'll revise that. We'll talk more about that moving forward. But you balance that. There are going to be things that you're going to pay a tax on, sales tax, that is, that you haven't been paying sales taxes on as well. So like telecommunication services, you know, your streaming services, any number of these types of bills that you may have that you've enjoyed without paying the tax, you will be paying the tax there. So we're going to try and do these calculations and put these things together for you in the coming weeks in advance of November 7th, I think, right around there when they hope to go into special session. We'll be right back. We'll check in with Scoot to see what he has coming your way on a free-for-all Friday. So stay with us. Scoot joins us on free-for-all Friday. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Wow, you know, we're getting close to Halloween. It's a time to be frightened. And, man, I was frightened at that game last night. What a frightening sight. Oh, my God. It was rough, Newell.
It was a long night, my friend.
It was a long night. You know, it was really a boring game, and not just because the Saints lost. I mean, even the Broncos had to kick a bunch of field goals, and, you know, that doesn't make for an exciting game, in my opinion. But, yeah, it was a boring game. You know, I have a lot of questions about what I perceive to be Dennis Allen's body language and what he says and how he says it in the post-game interviews. So, you know, we have a lot to talk about with that. A lot of stuff going on this weekend. It's a beautiful day. We'll talk a little bit about politics with the election coming up. And I hope you have a great weekend.
All righty. Scoot's headed your way, folks. Hope you enjoyed today's show. We'll see you Monday.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.